close to full-on war, and I'm pretty sure we've got some bad guys to kill.
Before I can reply, Malcolm steps forward.
The sanctuary might be our best hope, he says, but it's best not to put all our eggs in one basket.
Nine's sort of right. As much as I hate the idea of splitting up again, Six says, some of us should stick with Walker's plan to take the fight to the Moogs and their people.
Nine pumps a fist. This guy!
And some of us should head to Mexico, I say, finishing Six's thought.
I want to go, Marina says immediately. I want to see the sanctuary. If it's a place for Lorik, a place where we lived, maybe that's where we should bury Eight's body.
I nod and look over at Six, waiting for her decision. Well, New York or Mexico?
Mexico, she says after a moment. You're better at dealing with these government types than I am. And if we need a Lorik representative at the UN, you're the obvious choice. Thanks.
I think.
She's saying that because you're such a Boy Scout,
Nine adds in a loud whisper. I glance over at Sam, who seems like he's about to speak, his mouth half open. He's cut off by Six, who subtly shakes her head at him.
I'll stay here too, I guess,
Sam says after an awkward moment, sounding more than a little deflated. He forces a smile for me.
Someone has to keep you and Nine in line.
That leaves only Adam. Our Mogadorian ally has maintained a respectful silence this whole time, probably trying not to step on any toes as the secrets of our race are revealed. When I turn to him, he's still gazing at the screen. He looks lost in memory, maybe remembering Dr. Anu and his machine. He frowns when he notices the rest of us watching him.
They'll be waiting for you in Mexico, Adam says. If there's a source of Lorik power there, you know my people have spent the last few years trying to access it.
Only the guard can get in, though, right?
Sam asks, looking from Adam to his dad.
It's what I said,
Malcolm replies, lips pursed in uncertainty.
Just like only we can have legacies,
Nine replies, eyeballing Adam.
You're saying this could be another trap, Moog?
It's not a trap when you know it's there,
Adam says, sparing a quick glance for Nine before turning his eyes toward Six.
I don't know exactly what you'll find down there, but I can guarantee a Mogadorian presence. I can pilot the skimmer better than you. Maybe outmaneuver them if they've got ships in the air?
Well, I sure as hell wasn't going to walk to Mexico, Six replies dryly.
She looks at me.
You trust this guy, right?
I do. She shrugs.
Then welcome to Team Kalakmul, Adam.
I hear Marina suck her teeth, but she doesn't make any other protest.
Great! We're sending a Mogadorian to investigate a Lorik holy place,
Nine complains, shaking his head.
Doesn't anyone else think that's sort of disrespectful?
Didn't you just refer to it as dusty ass? Sam asks.
Statement of fact,
Nine says.
Just like this whole good Moog thing is still hella weird. No offense.
I silence the banter when I reach under my shirt and pull my Lorik pendant over my head. I feel an odd coldness against my heart when it's gone. I can't remember the last time I was without it. With the room suddenly gone quiet again, I hold out the pendant to Six. Take it, I say. Make sure it gets to the sanctuary.
No pressure,
Six says, smirking as she accepts the pendant. Now, I say, looking around, let's win this war and change the world.
Chapter 18. We say goodbye later that morning. All of us gathered around the skimmer on the Ashwood Estates basketball court. It feels strange to be wearing a Lorik pendant around my neck again. And I don't mean literal physical weight. The pendants themselves aren't heavy at all. They just contain all the legacies of Lorien, apparently. All the power of our nearly extinct people, imbued into a few glistening Lorelite stones. Yeah, no big deal. Is that everything? Marina asks. She's on her knees in front of her open chest, gently rearranging its contents. We've got 8's chest as well. Its contents are forever locked up, possibly destroyed, but we figured it couldn't hurt to bring it to the sanctuary with the rest. I don't have a chest of my own, so Marina has to put all of our collected inheritance into hers. After our meeting earlier, John and Nine went through their chests and gathered together anything that wasn't a weapon, a healing stone, or otherwise combat-related. Besides the handful of Loric gemstones yet to be traded for penthouses or computer equipment, John handed over a bundle of dried leaves tied with a yellowed piece of twine that make the sound of the wind when my fingers brush against them, and Nine gives up a pouch of soft, coffee-dark soil. Marina carefully put these items into her chest, alongside a vial of crystal-clear water, a stray piece of Lorelite, and a tree branch with the bark pared away. So, because we don't know what exactly these phoenix stones are, we'll just dump anything that's close, right? I say, then hastily correct myself. I mean, not dump. Commit to the earth. What brainwashed Malcolm said. John laughs a little. If we come up with a better plan, I'll let you know. Dad's still down there watching more tapes, Sam offers. Maybe he'll find something else. Right now, winging it seems like the only option, on pretty much every front, John says. There's something else I want you to take to the sanctuary, Six. John crouches down to reach into his chest. I was wondering why he'd brought it with him to the basketball court after we already went through it inside. I understand when he holds out a small can that I immediately recognize. Henri's ashes. John, I say, not accepting the can right away. Take him, John replies gently. He belongs at the sanctuary. But don't you want to be there? To say goodbye? Of course I do. But with everything that's happening, I don't know if I'll have a chance. When I start to protest again, John cuts me off. It's okay, Six. I'll feel better knowing he's with you, headed to the sanctuary. If it's what you want, I say, accepting the ashes. I'll take care of him, I promise. I carefully place the can of Henri's ashes in Marina's chest with the rest of our stuff. We all fall silent, the mood turning somber. It's hard to have this kind of moment when you're being watched, though. The government agents keep their distance, although I can see some of them, including Walker herself, watching us from a nearby porch. You going to be all right with them? I ask John. He looks around, noting all the prying eyes. They're on our side now, remember? I have to keep reminding myself, I reply. My gaze involuntarily turning towards the skimmer. Seems like I'm doing that a lot. Adam is already on board the skimmer, along with Dust, the chimera that's bonded with him. I'm taking John at his word that we can trust the wiry Mogadorian currently running diagnostics in the cockpit. I'm not sure Marina feels the same. She hasn't said anything outright, but I can feel cold radiating from her whenever Adam's near. After everything that's happened, I can't blame her for being suspicious. I've resigned myself to a very chilly flight to Mexico. Check in often, John reminds me, tapping the phone that he's clipped to the hip of his jeans like a total dork. Both Marina and I are now in possession of satellite phones, too bulky to wear as fashion accessories, so they're stored with the rest of our supplies. The gear arrived courtesy of the U.S. government, or at least the rebel faction that Walker has ties with. Both Adam and Malcolm looked over the phones and assured us they aren't bugged. Yeah, yeah, I reply. You too, John. Stay in touch. Stay alive. And take care of all our stuff, Nine grumbles. He's standing a few paces off, watching Marina mess with her chest, his eyebrows furrowed. I want some of those gems back if possible. You know, for after. Need to buy a new place to live, thanks to my shitty house-sitter over here. I shoot Nine a look. Are you serious right now? He shrugs. What? Got a plan for the future? Marina looks up from her chest and, with a sigh, tosses Nine a pair of dark gloves. Here, I never figured out what to do with these. Sweet, Nine says and pulls them on immediately. He flexes his fingers inside the leather-like material, then violently thrusts his palms out towards John. Did you feel anything, dude? John ignores Nine, looking at Marina. Can we be sure those aren't important? What if they're a phoenix stone? They're gloves, Johnny, Nine says, not taking them off. You ever heard of an ancient ritual that involves burying a pair of stylish-ass gloves? Come on. John shakes his head, giving up. His eyes linger on Henri's ashes until Marina closes her chest, and then his gaze drifts toward the skimmer. I wish I could come with you. I'd like to be there for both of them. Eight's body is already on board the skimmer, strapped securely to one of the seats. After, Marina says, and she reaches out to squeeze John's hand. She's still walking around with a lot of sadness. We all are. But I'm slowly seeing signs that the old, gentle Marina is melting all that ice. Eight would understand. Once we've won, there will be time for us to pay our respects properly. All of us together. Nine stops screwing with his new gloves and gets serious for a moment, looking at Marina. I'd like that, he says. Ready? I ask Marina. She nods and uses her telekinesis to float her chest into the skimmer's entrance. Be safe, all of you. One by one, Marina hugs the boys, and I do the same. Sam is last for me, and when he wraps me up in a big hug, I get the same feeling that I did before when we were all assembled in the Mogadorian tunnels, that everyone is watching us and tittering about how precious we are. I bristle a little bit, but before I know it, the hug has lasted way longer than the others, and our friends have drifted a few steps away, as if to let us have a discreet moment. Six, Sam says quietly against my ear, and I pull back enough to look at him, cutting him off. Don't make this weird, Sam, I whisper, and tuck a loose strand of hair behind my ear, glancing surreptitiously toward the others. So we spent last night together. Maybe that wasn't the wisest move on my part. I love Sam, in my way, and I don't want to string him along or hurt his feelings. I'm just still not sold on having any kind of relationship until this is all over, especially with how stupid and complicated things got with John after just some flirting. But after everything that happened in Florida, I needed something good for a change. Something warm and safe and approaching normal. And that was Sam. I thought he understood that I didn't want to get into some dopey John-Sarah-style star-crossed lovers thing with him. But here we are, having a moment. And blunt as I'm trying to be, I'm not exactly pulling away either. I'm not making it anything, Sam says, screwing up his face at me. I don't get why you didn't want me coming with you. You'll do more good here, with your dad, I tell him. And you'll need to keep John and Nine in line. The last time I went on a mission with John, he left me inside a mountain, Sam says, not buying it. Come on, Six. What is it really? I sigh, simultaneously wanting to strangle him and kiss him. For a second, I'm not sure which instinct will win out. I want something more with Sam, I think. Eventually. I just don't want to think about it right now. Last night was one thing, but now I'm back to fighting a war. I don't want the distraction, Sam, all right? Oh, he says, looking like I've just murdered his pride. You mean like You'd have to keep saving me from Moogs or stop me from stepping on some ancient Mayan spike trap or whatever. Because I thought we were past that. I can handle myself, Six. And I only accidentally shot you that one time in practice, and... I kiss him. Mostly just to shut him up and illustrate my point. But also because I just can't help myself. I hear Nine make an oohing noise off to the side and make a mental note to destroy him the next chance I get. That's the distraction I'm talking about, I say quietly, my face still close to his. Sam is blushing again, and his mouth is still working like he wants to say something more. He's probably trying to come up with some smooth way to say goodbye, but I'm sick of these drawn-out moments. So I take one last look at his sweet, dumbstruck face and turn away. A few seconds later, I'm strapped into the skimmer's seat next to Adam, ignoring the raised eyebrow and smirk Marina's fixing me with. "Shall we?" Adam asks. We nod, and Adam throws some switches, handling the skimmer's controls with much more confidence than I did. As we slowly rise up, I look out the window to see Sam and the others below, waving goodbye to us. I wonder if my life will ever be without these moments, the painful goodbyes before we all go off to risk our lives. John always talks about how much he can't wait for some boring, normal life, but would I be happy like that? We gain altitude, trees zipping by beneath us, and I think about Sam. If it wasn't for this war, the constant chaos, we'd have never even gotten together. What would it be like for us without the looming threat of Mogadorian destruction? I'd like to find out.
Chapter 19. Nine leans across me so that he can get a good look at Sam, saying to him in a stage whisper,
"All right, dude, what's the deal with you and Six?"
Sam pointedly looks out the window of the van.
"What?"
"Nothing." Nine snorts.
"Come on, man. It's like a 4-hour drive to New York. You gotta give up some details."
In front of us, in the passenger seat, Agent Walker clears her throat.
"Fascinating as I find the sex lives of teenage boys, maybe we could use this time to go over our operational parameters," she says dryly.
"Agreed," I say, shoving Nine back in his seat so he can't leer at Sam anymore. "We need to focus on the mission." Nine frowns at me.
"All right, John, I'm gonna focus my ass off for the rest of this car ride."
"Good." Sam flashes me a grateful smile and I nod. Part of me really does think we should be thinking about the impossible odds we're facing, but another part of me just doesn't want to hear any details about Sam and Six. I'm happy for them, I guess. Glad they could find some comfort together. But I can't get over the feeling that Sam is going to end up with his heart broken. I remember my vision of the future, the way Sam screamed right before the Mogadorians executed Six. Maybe that's why I get the sinking feeling this is going to end badly. Or maybe I'm just jealous. Not because Sam hooked up with Six, but more because the love of my life is miles away. Of course, there's no way I'm expressing any of that in front of Nine, or Walker, and the silent FBI guy driving the car. Yeah. Let's focus on the mission. We're driving up I-95 from Washington to New York. Malcolm stayed behind at Ashwood Estates to finish going through the Mogadorian archives, hoping to turn up something else that might be useful. The vast majority of Walker's renegade agents stayed back, too. They're holding down the fort, using it as a base of operations to coordinate their efforts to undermine MogPro. I still don't entirely trust Walker's people, and I probably won't ever reach that level after everything the government put us through. So I left behind our 5 remaining Chimerae with orders to protect Malcolm at all costs. Besides Walker and our driver, There's another SUV filled with agents following along behind us. That makes a grand total of 6 agents, plus me, 9, and Sam. Not much of an army. But then, the war hasn't started yet. Maybe if everything goes according to my plan, it won't start at all. Secretary of Defense Sanderson is staying at a hotel in Midtown Manhattan, close to the UN, Walker says. She glances down at her phone, which she's been typing away on all morning. I had a mole on his security team, but...
But what?
They were pulled this morning, Walker replies. All his bodyguards replaced by a new team. Pale guys in dark trench coats. Sound familiar?
Mogadorians,
Nine says, grinding his fist into his palm.
Keeping their pet politician safe before his big sellout speech.
I think it actually works to our advantage, Walker says, looking at me. My people weren't looking forward to fighting through their own on the way to Sanderson. I mean, some of these guys are just doing their jobs.
Yeah, we aren't in the habit of fighting humans either, I say, giving Walker a pointed look. Unless they make us.
So that's the whole plan? Sam asks, skeptical. We go to this hotel, fight our way through a bunch of Moogs, and then kill this Sanderson guy?
Yes, Walker answers.
No, I say. Everyone looks at me. Even our stoic driver is staring at me in the rearview mirror.
What do you mean, no? Walker asks, her eyebrows raised. I thought we were clear on this.
We're not killing Sanderson, I say. We don't fight humans. We sure as hell don't kill them.
Kid, I'll pull the trigger if you get me in front of him, Walker replies.
You can arrest him if you want, I say. Charge him with treason.
The penalty for treason is death, Walker exclaims, sounding exasperated. Anyway, his Moog Pro cronies won't let an arrest go through. And you think anything in the courts is going to matter once Cetricus Ra is here?
You said it, I reply. Cetricus Ra is who's important.
Right. Instead of Sanderson, it'll be you guys there to greet him at the UN. We'll show the world the difference between good aliens and bad aliens. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, my people will dismantle Moog Pro.
Walker rubs her temples.
I've got other agents already in position. Around the time we take out Sanderson, a dozen other Moog Pro traitors will...
I cut her off. If you're about to tell me more assassinations, I don't want to know. Nine raises his hand.
I want to know!
That's not what we do, Walker, I continue. It's not what we're about.
Kid, you want to get the word out about the Moogs? Sooner or later, you're going to have to get your hands dirty.
And what if Sanderson gets the word out for us? Walker squints at me.
What are you talking about?
He's giving a speech at the UN, right? Going to talk up Cetricus Ra, tell humanity how it's safe to welcome the Mogadorian fleet? I shrug, trying to seem nonchalant about this, confident in my plan.
Maybe he gives a different speech. Maybe he delivers a warning. You're talking about turning him?
Walker exclaims.
This late in the game? You're out of your mind!
I don't think so, I reply, glancing left and right at Nine and Sam. My friends and I are pretty persuasive.
Yeah!
Nine jumps in, grinning fiercely at Walker.
I'm convincing as all hell!
Walker stares at me for a long moment, then turns around and goes back to typing coded messages into her phone.
I didn't realize I was teaming up with some hippy-dippy peacenik aliens, she sighs. Fine. If you can talk Sanderson into flipping sides in front of the UN, go for it. But if I'm not convinced, I'm shooting him.
Sure, I reply to Walker.
You're in charge.
We stop at a gas station in New Jersey to fill up the SUVs. Since I've got a few minutes alone, I decide it's a good time to check in with Sarah.
I take out my phone and wander across the parking lot. As I do, I can feel Walker's eyes boring into my back.
"Where are you going?" she calls after me.
"To call my girlfriend," I say, raising the phone. "Remember? You illegally detained her that one time?"
"Oh, great,"
Walker replies. I can hear her mutter to the driver.
"We're depending on a bunch of horny teenagers to save the world."
Better us than people like Walker, I think, but pretend not to have heard her snide remark. The phone rings 5 times, each one causing my heart to beat a little faster, before Sarah answers, narrowly evading the dump to voicemail.
"Before you say anything,"
she begins, not even saying hello, her voice shaky,
"I just want you to know that I'm okay."
"What happened?" I ask, trying to keep that first rush of panic out of my voice. I can hear the sound of traffic in the background. Sarah's in a moving car.
"We went into town for supplies and had a run-in with some Moogs," Sarah says, still catching her breath. "I guess they tracked us down somehow, not too happy about the they walk among us thing. Don't worry, we're all fine. Bernie Kosar handled them."
"Are you somewhere safe?"
"We will be soon," she replies. "Mark's hacker buddy, Guard, gave us directions to his home base in Atlanta."
Mark had some details about Guard in one of his emails to Sarah. He's another conspiracy junkie, like one of those guys from the old version of They Walk Among Us. But he's also an excellent hacker and, according to Mark, has access to a surprising amount of information. It makes me a little nervous that Sarah and Mark are headed to meet him without us knowing his identity.
"What does Mark know about this guy?" I ask.
Sarah repeats my question to Mark. I can't quite make out his reply over all the noise from the road.
"Mark says he's probably some nerd hiding out in his mom's basement," Sarah repeats dryly, "but that he's a solid dude and that we can trust him."
I roll my eyes at Mark's scouting report.
"That's heartening. Just in case, I'm going to text you the location of somewhere safe. It's a base in Washington that we took over, loaded with government guys who are on our side. If you need somewhere to run to, you could head there."
I hear 2 engines rumble to life behind me. I turn around to see all of Walker's agents piled into the cars. 9 and Sam still stand outside our SUV, waiting for me. 9 makes an impatient "wrap it up" motion.
"What's going on there?"
Sarah asks me.
"On your way to do something stupid but possibly world-saving?"
"Pretty much," I reply, allowing myself a faint smile. "Did you get those documents I sent you?"
"Yeah," Sarah replies. "We'll have a chance to upload them once we're in Atlanta."
"Perfect. I've got a feeling They Walk Among Us is about to get a lot more hits." I pause, reluctant to get off the phone.
"The others are waiting for me. I've got to go."
"Mark says to go kick some ass, and I love you."
Sarah catches herself laughing.
"Mark didn't say that last part. That was for me."
We say our goodbyes, and I'm left with that same feeling of longing, mixed with dread that I get after every one of these phone conversations. I trudge back to the SUV. Everyone else is already inside except for Sam.
"So you're putting all of Walker's documents on They Walk Among Us?" Sam asks. "It's a good idea, like anti-Mogadorian propaganda."
"It's a desperate idea is what it is," I say glumly. "No one's going to be digging through search results while their cities are getting bombarded."
"There's a comforting thought," Sam replies, frowning. "But seriously, that's a lot of heavy reading. If you're trying to get people on our side, it shouldn't just be about the Mogadorians. You shouldn't just be trying to scare people. They'll be scared enough as it is. You've got to give them some hope."
"What do you suggest?"
Sam thinks about it for a second, then shrugs. "I don't know yet. I'll come up with something."
I nod and pat Sam on the shoulder, the 2 of us climbing back into the car. I know he's just trying to help, and that's why I don't tell him that whatever he comes up with, it might be too late. We make it to New York about 1 hour later. I've never been here before, and neither have Nine or Sam. I wish our visit could be under different circumstances. As we inch along in heavy traffic through a canyon of skyscrapers, I find myself craning my neck to look out the window. Chicago is a huge city, but the frenetic jostle of pedestrians on the sidewalks here is something else entirely. There are flashing signs advertising Broadway shows, yellow cabs darting in and out of traffic, a hum of activity all around us. And these people have no idea what's heading their way. As we drive farther uptown towards Sanderson's hotel, we pass a dude wearing a cowboy hat and underwear, strumming an acoustic guitar for a crowd of tourists. Nine snorts.
"Look at this," he says, shaking his head. "That shit wouldn't fly in Chicago."
I lean forward to get Walker's attention. "Are we close?"
"A few more blocks," she replies.
I reach down to make sure my Lorik dagger is still fastened securely to my leg. I also touch my wrist, reflex telling me to check for my shield bracelet, except that it's gone, destroyed by the general. "Did your guy on the scene tell you how many Moogs we should be expecting?" I ask Walker.
"A dozen, maybe more."
"That's nothing,"
Nine says, pulling on the gloves that Marina gave him. He clenches his fists, and I inch away from him, wary that he's going to accidentally trigger some kind of weapon. Thankfully, nothing happens.
"You're wearing those into a fight?" Sam asks, eyeing Nine incredulously. "You don't even know what they do."
"What better way to find out?"
Nine replies.
"These Lorik things, man, they have a way of not helping you until you've given up on them."
"Or maybe they're just for keeping your hands warm," Sam suggests.
"Just don't do anything stupid," I tell Nine, and he stares at me, his expression getting deathly serious.
"John, I won't," he says. "For real. You can trust me out there."
I can tell Nine is still carrying around what happened down in Florida and is eager to prove himself. I just nod at him, knowing he wouldn't want me to make a big deal out of it. I'm glad he's got my back. Walker turns around to look at Sam.
"These guys shoot fireballs and have magic gloves, apparently, but what do you do?"
Sam looks momentarily taken aback, and I notice him reach down to touch the scars burned into his wrists. After a moment's consideration, he looks Walker in the eye.
"I've probably killed more Moogs than you have, lady," Sam replies.
Nine elbows me, and I can't help but grin. To her credit, that actually looks like the answer Walker was hoping for. She opens the glove compartment, pulls out a holstered handgun, and holds it out to Sam.
"Well, I'm officially arming a minor," she says. "Do your country proud, Samuel."
A minute later, our driver pulls over to the side of one of Manhattan's quieter blocks, double parking. The other SUV rolls up behind us. Across the street and down the block a bit is the entrance to a posh hotel. There's a wide awning out front and a red carpet, a place for guests to turn over their car keys to a valet and drop their bags onto one of the waiting luggage carts. Except there's no activity outside the hotel. No tourists strolling the sidewalk, no valets waiting for tips. Nothing. Everything's been cleared away or scared off by the trio of Mogadorians standing guard at the door, their coats brazenly open to reveal the blasters hanging from their belts. It's like they're not even bothering to hide anymore.
"We want to do this quick and clean,"
Walker says to us, hunching low in her seat so she can look at the Moogs in her side-view mirror.
"Take down the Moogs and get to Sanderson before they can send up an alarm, radio for backup, or whatever they do."
"Yeah, got it," I reply quickly. I pull up the hood on my sweatshirt so that it hides my face. "We've done this before."
"Let my people lead," Walker says. "We'll flash some badges, maybe confuse them, then you hit them hard."
"Sure, you distract them," Nine says. "But then get the hell out of our way."
Walker picks up a walkie-talkie and radios to the agents in the second car.
You guys ready?
Affirmative,
a male voice answers.
Let's do this.
Here we go,
says an excited nine and claps his gloved hands together. The concussion of sound that detonates from Nine's hands when he claps isn't quite sonic boom loud, but it's definitely close. It's like a thunderclap in the back seat. All of the SUV's windows explode outward, and the car even bounces a few inches into the air. The SUV behind us doesn't fare much better. Its windows also shatter, but inward, spraying the agents huddled inside. The windows of nearby storefronts break too, and a pedestrian walking by is knocked clear off her feet. Next to me, Sam is squeezing the sides of his head, looking dazed. For the first few seconds, I can't hear much except a low chirping that I soon realize is car alarms going off up and down the block. I turn to Nine, wide-eyed, and catch him staring at his gloved hands, also wide-eyed. I can't hear what he says, and I'm not much of a lip reader, but I'm pretty sure it's... oops. At the entrance of the hotel, one Mogadorian is down on his knees, clutching his head. The other two are pointing right at our SUV, raising their blasters. So much for the element of surprise. Chapter 20. With the way my ears are ringing, I don't really hear the first volley of Mogadorian blaster fire, but I feel it. The SUV is rocked to the side as the jagged energy bolts shear across the car's bulletproof paneling. Walker huddles for cover behind the door, keeping her head down. Our driver isn't so lucky. A blast comes sizzling through the window and hits him in the side of the neck. His flesh is burned badly, and he immediately starts convulsing. Go! I shout, unable to hear myself and not sure if anyone else can either. Go! Nine rips open the back door of the SUV, literally. As he gets out of the car, he holds the door in front of him, using it as a shield to absorb the Moog's fire. I lunge into the front seat and press my hands onto the FBI agent's blaster wound, letting my warm, healing energy flow into him. Slowly, the injury begins to knit itself closed, and his convulsions stop. The agent looks up at me with wide, grateful eyes. I sense movement to my left and turn my head. Outside the driver's side window is the pedestrian who got knocked down when Nine's thunderclap went off. She's a pretty college-aged girl with big brown eyes. She looks shell-shocked and seems to be rooted in place, except she's not so stunned that she failed to get her phone out of her purse. She's just finished recording me healing our driver and is filming my face as I shouted her to run. Another volley of Moog blaster fire bounces over the hood of our SUV, nearly hitting the girl. Sam springs out of the back seat and grabs her. He drags her farther down the sidewalk and puts her in cover behind some parked cars. Months ago, my face on video after using my legacies would have been a disaster. But now I don't even care. However, we can't let any more innocent people wander into our war zone. Turn the car! I shout in our driver's ear. I'm not sure he can hear me, so I make a steering wheel motion with my hands. Block the street off! He gets it and peels out. I can smell the burned rubber, but don't quite hear it. He gets the car parked perpendicular across the middle of the road, blocking any traffic. I hop out of the SUV and turn towards the hotel just in time to see a Mogadorian warrior sheared in half and turned to dust by our car door, which Nine flung through the air, discus style. Meanwhile, the agents in the second car have managed to collect themselves. Seeing our maneuver, their driver throws his SUV into reverse, and they quickly block access to the road from the other direction. Then they jump out, using their SUV as cover, and return fire on the remaining Mogadorians. The gunfire is barely audible, popping in my damaged ears. One of the Moogs keels over from a well-placed bullet to the forehead. Outnumbered, the remaining Moog ducks into the hotel doorway for cover. I reach out with my telekinesis, grab a luggage cart parked behind the Moog, and jerk it forward so that it takes out the back of his legs. As he stumbles out of the doorway, Walker's agents light him up. Nine glances back to me and I nod. Together, we rush towards the entrance. I look over my shoulder to check on Sam and see him still talking to that bystander, gesturing emphatically at her cell phone. No time to worry about that now. Inside, the posh hotel lobby is completely deserted, except for a frightened clerk cowering behind the front desk. Beyond the marble columns and leather couches of the waiting area is the elevator bank. Oddly, two of the three elevators are out of service, and the third is stuck up at the penthouse level. The Moogs might not have expected an assault, but they definitely took precautions. With a moment to catch my breath, I press my hands to the sides of my head and let some of that healing energy flow into my ears. They pop and crackle, but sound slowly returns, like a volume dial in my head being gradually turned up. From outside, I can hear sirens, screeching tires, and Walker's people yelling at local cops to stay back. Our plan to do this covertly is already shot. Now, we just have to be quick. I grab Nine before he can make it to the elevators and clap my hands to the side of his head, healing him as well. When I'm done, he shakes his head back and forth like he's trying to dislodge water from his inner ear. "You're an idiot," I tell him. Nine shakes the sonic gloves at me before stuffing them in his back pocket.
"At least now we know what they do."
Seeing that we weren't gun-toting Mogadorians, the guy at the front desk slowly comes out of hiding. He's skinny and middle-aged, and from the bags under his eyes, he looks as if he's having one terrible day.
"What? What is going on?"
the clerk asks us. Before we can answer, Walker strides through the door. She flashes the clerk her badge and then shouts,
"What floor is Sanderson on?"
The wide-eyed clerk glances from Walker to us and then back.
Penthouse, he stammers. Those things you killed are with him. They cleared out the entire hotel this morning except for me and some of the staff, and I'm not even the manager.
Nine stares at the clerk, trying to make sense of him.
Why would they keep you around?
They've been ordering room service,
he responds incredulously, his voice squeaky.
Acting like they own the place and we're their servants.
That's some ballsy shit,
Nine says, shaking his head.
Like they've already taken over or something.
Walker squints at the clerk like she could strangle him, then turns to me, her voice still incredibly loud.
God damn it, I can't hear this guy!
I wave her over and press my hands to her ears. While I'm healing Walker, I look over at the clerk. You should get out of here. Go outside very slowly with your hands up. We'll send out anyone else we come across. The clerk nods mutely, then begins taking baby steps towards the exit, his hands raised above his head. Walker shakes off my hands as soon as her hearing is back.
What did he say?
He said we're going up, I reply, pointing to the elevator.
Actually,
Nine says,
they're coming down.
The hotel's one working elevator has begun to descend, the little lights above ticking off the floors. I light my lumen, the whoosh of flames feeling good. Walker adjusts her grip on her pistol.
Easy, guys,
Nine says.
I've got this.
Nine picks up one of the leather sofas and holds it like a battering ram. Walker and I both step aside, giving him room. When the elevator dings and the doors slide apart, the four Mogadorians sent downstairs to reinforce the ones we've already dispatched are greeted by Nine, screaming and shoving a sofa into them. One of them manages to get a burst of blaster fire off, but it sizzles harmlessly against the floor. The entire unit is pinned inside the elevator, the centermost Moog crushed outright behind Nine's weight. Walker easily darts around Nine and picks the Moogs off with her handgun.
"That still doesn't make up for the whole glove thing," I tell Nine as he effortlessly tosses the sofa back into the lobby.
"Come on,"
Nine complains, grinning.
"It was an accident."
"Are there any other alien gadgets I need to be aware of?" Walker asks as we pile into the elevator and hit the button for the top floor.
"Well, there's this,"
Nine replies and pulls a string of three emerald green stones out of his pocket.
I remember that thing from before.
When Nine throws it, the string creates a miniature vacuum, sucks up whatever's close, and then spits it violently back out. He must have taken it out of his chest before turning over the rest of his inheritance to Marina and Six.
"What does that do?" Walker asks.
"You'll see," I reply, looking at Nine. "You know there will be more waiting for us outside the elevator, right?"
"My thoughts exactly,"
he replies, grinning. I pull Walker close so that we're pressed against the side of the elevator, right up against the buttons. Nine takes cover against the opposite wall, lazily swinging his string of stones like a bolo.
"You might need to hold on to me," I tell Walker. "You've seen how Nine does with gadgets."
"Hey,"
Nine says, wounded.
"This one I actually know how to work."
Seconds later, the elevator doors open, and a barrage of blaster fire hammers the elevator's back wall. The Moogs up here adopting a strategy of shoot first and ask questions later. Without poking his head out of cover, Nine tosses the strand of stones outside the elevator. I imagine Nine's weapon working like it did back at the cabin, the beads hovering in a perfect circle, spinning slowly forward, sucking up anything in their path. I can hear the whoosh of air, followed by Mogadorian screams and a lot of futile shooting. Glass breaks as framed pictures are torn from the hallway walls, the pieces sucked into the miniature vacuum. Nine snaps his fingers, and everything the vacuum collected explodes outward. Violently expelled from the suction, one Mogadorian comes flying into the elevator. His head smashes hard against the back wall, his neck broken. Outside, everything is quiet. When it's over, I stick my head outside the doors. The air is filled with swirling dust particles that might be Mogadorian remains. A blaster that somehow became wedged against the ceiling clatters to the floor. Aside from that, the only thing in the hallway is a room service cart that looks like it's gone through a grinder. Its legs bent and twisted. There's only one door at the end of the short hallway, the one for the penthouse, and it's now half broken off its hinges.
"What the hell was that thing?" Walker asks, incredulous.
"The Moogs aren't the only one with kick-ass weaponry,"
Nine says, picking up the harmless-looking stone strand from where it landed on the floor. "Don't get any ideas," I say to Walker when I catch her craning her neck to get a look at the stones. "Our technology isn't for sale." Walker frowns at me.
"Yeah, well, judging by that bullshit with the gloves, you don't know how to work it anyway."
From the broken doorway up ahead, I hear the droning of a television. It's turned to cable news, I think. Some talking head rambling on about stock prices. Other than that, the hallway is totally quiet. There isn't any sign of more Mogadorians. Even so, we advance cautiously towards the penthouse door. Wary of an ambush, I nudge the door with my telekinesis before we get too close. It comes off the hinges easily and falls into the penthouse with a thud. The living room inside is dark, all the curtains drawn and lit only by the blue glow of the television.
"Come on in,"
a gravelly voice calls from inside.
"There's no one in here who can hurt you."
"That's Sanderson," Walker whispers.
I exchange a quick look with Nine. He shrugs and waves towards the door. I go first, Nine right behind me, and Walker bringing up the rear. The first thing I notice is a damp, moldy smell in the hotel room. It smells like rot, with an undercurrent of minty, old man joint cream. A map of New York City is spread across the table in the suite's dining area, notes in Mogadorian scribbled at various locations. Next to the table is a knocked-over chair, as if someone got up in a hurry. There are also Mogadorian cannons propped up against one wall, along with some dark canvas backpacks of gear. I notice a laptop, a few cell phones, and a thick, leather-bound book. None of that interests me as much as the old man seated at the edge of the suite's slept-in king-sized bed. He watches the TV through the open bedroom doorway, maybe too weak to walk himself into the penthouse's living room.
"God damn, dude!"
Nine exclaims upon seeing Sanderson.
"What is wrong with you?"
I've seen a lot of pictures of Bud Sanderson over the last few days. The first was on They Walk Among Us. Sanderson is an old man with thinning white hair, jowls, and a paunch. On the website, in a tabloid-style story I didn't think too much about, Mark James accused Sanderson of using some kind of Mogadorian anti-aging treatment. The next time I saw Sanderson was in Agent Walker's file, having lunch with a disguised Cetricus Ra. Hale and hearty, silver hair full and slick back, looking like he might jog a few miles after his Cobb salad. The Sanderson in front of me doesn't look like either of those pictures. Nine and I walk into the bedroom to get a closer look, Walker lingering behind. The Secretary of Defense is a frail old man, his hunched body wrapped up in a puffy hotel robe. The right side of his face looks saggy and collapsed, his eye socket droops, and his jawline disappears beneath folds of loose skin. His white hair is badly thinned, a comb-over barely managing to hide a smattering of age spots. He smiles at us, or maybe it's a grimace. His teeth yellow, gums receding. In the open neck of his robe and along his forearms, I notice some prominent veins that are discolored black.
"Number 4 and number 9,
Sanderson says, pointing a shaky finger at me and then Nine. He doesn't seem offended at all by Nine's grossed-out reaction, doesn't even seem to have noticed.
"Your pictures have been crossing my desk for years. Furtive shots from security cameras and the like. I practically watched you boys grow up."
Sanderson sounds like a reminiscent, doddering grandfather. I'm completely taken aback. I'd been expecting a sellout politician to try hitting me with talking points on Mogadorian progress. This guy barely looks capable of getting up from his bed, much less giving a speech in front of the UN.
"And you,"
Sanderson tilts his head to get a look at Walker.
"You're one of mine, aren't you?"
"Special Agent Karen Walker," she replies, stepping into the doorway. "Not one of yours. I serve humanity now, sir."
"Well, that's nice,"
Sanderson says dismissively. He doesn't seem at all interested in her, the way his beady black eyes settle on Nine and me, like we're his long-lost relatives gathered around his deathbed, makes me seriously uncomfortable. Even Nine has slipped into an awkward silence. I notice a small kit on the bed next to Sanderson. It contains a few sleek syringes, filled with a dark liquid that reminds me vaguely of Piken blood. I take a step towards him, my voice low. "What did they do to you?"
"Nothing I didn't ask for,"
Sanderson replies sadly.
"I wish you boys would have found me sooner. Now it's too late."
"Like hell!"
Nine says.
Even if you kill me, it won't make any difference,
Sanderson rasps, resignedly. We're not here to kill you, I reply. I don't know what they've told you, what they've filled your mind and body with, but we're not done fighting.
Oh, but I am.
Sanderson replies and pulls a small handgun out of his robe's front pocket. Before I can stop him, he holds the pistol next to his temple and pulls the trigger. Chapter 21. If I'd had time to think about it, I probably wouldn't have been able to do it. There's about a millimeter of space between Bud Sanderson's temple and the barrel of his gun. It's in that space that I managed to stop the bullet, holding it there with my telekinesis. The precision required makes me grunt from exertion. Every muscle in my body is tensed, my fists clenched and toes curled. It's like I flung my entire body into stopping that bullet. I can't believe I just did that. I've never done anything so precise before. A ring-shaped burn from the pistol's barrel forms on Sanderson's temple, but otherwise, his head is totally intact. It takes until the pistol's report stops echoing for the Secretary of Defense to realize his suicide attempt didn't work. He blinks his watery eyes at me, not quite understanding why he's still alive.
How?
Before Sanderson can pull the trigger again, Nine lunges forward and slaps the gun out of his hand. I exhale very slowly and allow my body to uncoil.
That's not right,
Sanderson says to me accusingly, his lower lip shaking as he rubs his wrist where Nine struck him.
Just let me die.
Seriously, Walker interjects, her hands tightening around her own gun. Why'd you stop him? Could have solved all our problems right there. It wouldn't have solved anything, I say, shooting her a look as I let the bullet drop harmlessly onto Sanderson's unmade bed.
He's right,
Sanderson says to Walker, his shoulders slumping.
Killing me won't change anything, but keeping me alive is simply cruel.
You don't get to decide when you check out, old man, I tell Sanderson. When we win this war, we'll let the people of Earth decide how they deal with traitors. Sanderson chuckles dryly.
The optimism of youth.
I crouch down to look him in the face. There's still time to redeem yourself, I say, to do something of value. Sanderson raises an eyebrow, and his eyes seem to focus up a bit. But then, the right side of his mouth droops, and he has to wipe away a blob of drool with the cuff of his robe. Looking utterly defeated, Sanderson averts his eyes.
No,
he says quietly.
I think not.
Nine sighs from boredom and picks up the kit of syringes laid out next to Sanderson. He studies the tar-colored sludge inside the injector for a moment, then waves it in Sanderson's face.
What is this shit they're giving you, huh?
Nine asks.
This? What you traded the planet for?
Sanderson peers longingly at the vials, but then weakly shoves them away.
They healed me, Sanderson explains. More than that, they made me young again.
And look at you now,
Nine grunts.
Fresh as a daisy, right?
You know, their leader has lived for centuries,
Sanderson counters, his eyes swinging wildly between me and Nine.
Of course you do. He promised us that. You promised immortality and power.
He lied, I say. Sanderson looks down at the floor.
Yes.
Pathetic, Walker says, but the venom's gone out of her. Like me, I don't think Sanderson has turned out to be the villain Walker expected. Maybe he was once the puppet master of an international conspiracy in support of Moogs. But at this point,
He's been entirely chewed up and spit out by Mogadorian progress. This isn't the game-changer Walker was hoping for. I'm worried that we've wasted what precious little time we have left. Sanderson ignores Nine and Walker. For some reason,